is my go-to beer. Not too heavy, not too light. Oh boy. Oh no. Is that on the computer? Sam Adams Boston Lager. The Boston Beer Company, Boston, Massachusetts. Drink responsibly.
The morning rush can be a beautiful thing. With the right granola bar, that is. Take a moment and take in the outdoors with Nature Valley Crunchy Bars.
For the ABC Information Network and KVOE, I'm Sherry Preston.
Thank you, Sherry. It is 10:06 KVOE, 1400 AM, 96.9 FM, live and local. The on-air chat on the way, but first a check of the KVOE weather forecast from the TV 13 weather team, being brought to you by the Bluestem Insurance Group. For all of your home, auto, farm, and commercial insurance needs, call the Bluestem Insurance Group, 620-342-4714, or stop by their office, 2501 West 18th Avenue, Suite C in Emporia. Heat advisory for Lion, Chase, Coffee, Greenwood, Morris, Osage, and Wabunsee counties continues until at least 8 o'clock tonight. We'll see if that doesn't get extended for tomorrow as well. Sunny skies today, a high 99 degrees. Heat index values up to around 106. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 76. Sunny and hot again tomorrow, a slight chance of afternoon showers and thunderstorms, a high of 97. Relief coming, though, 40% chance of rain Thursday night, a low 71. 40% chance of rain Friday, a high of 89. 30% chance of rain Saturday, mainly early, otherwise sunny and 86 degrees.
Hi, this is Joe Turek at Bluestem Insurance Group. I have partnered with Buckeye Insurance Group to provide comprehensive coverage at competitive rates backed by outstanding service. If you would like a no-obligation review of your farm, home, or auto insurance, see me, Joe Turek, at Bluestem Insurance Group, 2501 West 18th Avenue, Suite C in Emporia, or call 620-342-4714. Buckeye Insurance Group and Bluestem Insurance Group, together we are insuring the heartland.
At the KVOE studios, yesterday's high 97 degrees, overnight low 77 degrees. We did see a peak wind gust, or peak heat index yesterday of 107. 0.4 of an inch of rain last night and overnight. Barometric pressure rising this hour to 29.89, relative humidity dropping slightly to 58%. Peak wind gusts of 32 miles an hour here over the last hour. Right now, a 21-mile-an-hour south wind, a sunny sky, and 85 degrees. Weather is service of Bluestem Insurance Group for all of your home, auto, farm, and commercial insurance needs. Call the Bluestem Insurance Group at 620-342-4714 or stop by their office, 2501 West 18th Avenue, Suite C in Emporia. KBOE, 1400 AM, 96.9 FM, live and local. Good Wednesday morning to you. I'm Scott Hayes. It's now 10:09.
KBOE, 1400 AM and 96.9 FM, live and local, present the on-air chat. Now, here are your hosts, Steve Souter and Aaron Harter.
Welcome to the on-air chat. Aaron Harter and Tegan Trahoon hosting today. We are brought to you by CB Financial. Craig Barnwell feels the income is the outcome that matters. Call 620-208-6777 for a free consultation. We're also brought to you by Bruce Davis Construction for commercial dirt work, demolition, dirt hauling, and more. Call Bruce Davis Construction, 342-5001. Good morning, Tegan.
Hey, good morning, Harter. How you doing?
I'm doing just fine. Yourself?
Doing all right. It's a beautiful day outside.
It is a beautiful day, yeah. If you like heat.
Well, you know, that's why I stay inside and look outside. That way I can enjoy the day without enjoying the heat.
You know what I mean? Plus the frosty windows help it keep cooler in here, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Our guest today is Corbin Basilovac. Good morning, Corbin.
Good morning, guys. Thanks for having me today. Appreciate it.
Yeah. We had you and your dad on, probably 3, 4, or 5 months ago. I don't know. Time is just flying
during this pandemic. Yeah.
And you had mentioned at the end that you were starting or in the middle of writing your own memoir. Is that a proper term for this book?
Yeah, I would say so. It's definitely a memoir.
And you have finished?
I have finished it. Just released last week on Amazon and then lots of bookstores up in Kansas City. So I'm pretty nervous about how it's going to go, but you got to do it.
Yeah. And you gave Tegan and myself a sneak preview, and it's a very interesting story, lots and lots to learn from. And let's start with you yourself before we get into a lot of the book details. Where'd you grow up? Where'd you go to high school? Where'd you go to college, et cetera?
Right. So grew up around here, grew up in Emporia, a lovely, easy place to live. And Aaron, you and I, we graduated right about the same era from Emporia High. Sports, fun times, dances, all the good things about Emporia. So moved away, went to University of Kansas, graduated from journalism school there, and loved that as well. So after KU, I went to Kansas City. Started working in the corporate world. Worked for a company called McLeod, similar to Birch or Valueline back in the day, as a telecom company and outside sales. And it was busy, and it was a lot of money. And
yeah, that was a hot time.
Yeah, you know, the telecom wars. You know,
sure.
All the declassifications and everything. So it was busy, but it was good, and we made a lot of money. And that's where things changed for me. I didn't know really what mental health was, but I started, you know, going from work to happy hours, and we'd celebrate because we were doing good. And happy hours would get later and later as the months went on. And then sooner or later, drinking led to other things. And so that's where my life changed. And it was bad decisions more than anything. I don't blame my family. I don't blame friends. I don't blame the job. It's bad decisions. And so, and I didn't realize it at the time, but I was dealing with anxiety, kind of depression. Even though I was doing well at work, I still wasn't happy with life. And so, you know, 2 or 3 years later, that led to crime, jail, and then now I'm out, and that's what the story's about. And the story's meant to be entertaining because the stories are, out, you know, eye-popping. But at the same time, it's supposed to be encouraging, and I hope it helps people.
You know, when you talk about corporate America and you talk about, you know, drug use and things like that, I think people's minds nowadays go straight to the movie The Wolf of Wall Street and they think about that. You talk about outrageous stories. Mm-hmm. Are we talking Wolf of Wall Street outrageous crazy, or are we just talking kind of, you know, you wouldn't believe this in a million years, but it really happened, you know, kind of maybe simmered down from that?
Sure. Definitely somewhat like Wolf of Wall Street. New York is a big monster compared to Kansas City.
Right.
So it was a miniaturized version of that. But we were wearing suits. We were staying up late. We were missing work sometimes.
More than a college frat party.
More than a college frat party. It was serious. It was real serious. I mean, people were driving cars and Benzes and women and all the stuff. All the stuff that is fleeting in life that's not substantial, but you think it's fun at the time. So yeah, it was somewhat like that, I would say.
Wow.
Yeah.
Does it just one thing rolls into another and you don't even realize that you're in the situation really? You go to the first happy hour and then somebody says, "Hey, you wanna go out after this?" and you go out after that, and then the next day you get into work and it's just kind of it's part of your daily routine, is it not?
It is. And about a year into it, I remember cocaine was big then. And so unfortunately, we were doing a lot of it. And I remember somebody saying, "Well, why can't we get this stuff more regularly?" And so an idea came to my head because I was thinking about money. I was thinking about greed. And so I found a way through my ways and means to get amounts of it. And then people were happy about it being more available, which just led to more people doing it. And more, it was a bad, you know, combination and roller coaster that got in over our heads for sure.
But you didn't really get into it for the money, necessarily. You just got into it so that you guys could just keep on going with your routine, correct?
Convenience, right. We were all, I say this with quotes, we were all good people. We weren't trying to break the law. We weren't trying to mess people's lives up. We just got caught up in something that really we couldn't control ourselves. But once money starts rolling in and you're first dealing with a few people, then you're dealing with more people, and then all of a sudden you think these people, quote, depend on you, or you think you're doing them a favor, or you think that you're necessary in their lives, then you think, well, maybe doing this is more important than my corporate job.
See, and I was going to ask you about that. When it came to you were able to get your hands on it and you were able to kind of help get it to your friends and make it more convenient, did you also feel a sense of maybe empowerment or maybe a sense of popularity as if we're going to high school terms, you
all
know?
All that stuff, yeah. And looking back, I'm ashamed of it, you know? But we get caught up in things, and it's a popularity thing. It's you want to impress people, you want to fit in. And, you know, that stuff is not how I feel about life now. I'm way more spiritual centered after going through what I did. And so But all those things led to that, yeah.
You talked a little bit about mental health issues and things like that, and you'd mentioned to us earlier, you know, anxiety is something that plays a role in your life. With that in mind, do you think that having that ability to kind of supply these to people and be kind of the popular kid, as it were, maybe helped your anxiety, and maybe that was something that kind of kept that ball rolling?
I thought it would, but it didn't.
Really?
I kept thinking it would for years. You know, oh, this is going to make me feel better. And then it would just, you get that feeling in your chest. And so it's, no, it never did.
Did it ever feel like it kind of temporarily filled that hole you needed, and then all of a sudden it's like, I need more? It's just,
very temporarily. Mm-hmm. Very temporarily, yeah. And I go over a lot of that stuff in depth in my book, yeah, about the feelings I had, about how I dealt with them badly for years by using drugs and selling drugs. But then I also go over how I dealt with it healthy, you know, in a healthy way, and how I overcame those things after finally being shocked over and over and over with bad decisions.
Gone through this whole thing, and we haven't even mentioned the name of the book yet. Why don't you tell us the title of the book?
Thank you, Aaron. Appreciate it. The name of the book is On to the Next Thing. It's a memoir on crime, choices, and change. And so far we've just been talking about the crime part. Right. You got to appreciate all three facets of the book, but the choices part is important, and the change part to me is the most important.
Yeah, I think we'll move in that order.
Good.
as we go, because obviously the change part is, well, I guess you were probably doing some change in your life while doing the crime, and you were obviously changing your life with some of the choices that you made, but most of the change came once you were incarcerated and post-incarceration. Is that fair?
Yeah, I would say so. I started to change right before I went into prison. I was sober for about a year before I went to prison, and then, of course, I've been sober since.
Right.
So, yeah.
So let's talk. Okay, so you're into this lifestyle of go to work all day, basically party all night. Is that a fair assumption?
Right.
And where does it – how long does that last?
Well, having the job, the corporate job, lasted only so long. You know, it lasted for about 3 years, but you can only do that for so long.
Right.
And so I eventually quit the job and then just did the selling of illegal substances permanently.
And how long did that go on for? Were you still hanging out with the same people, or was it more of just a regular what you see on TV drug deal? Here you go. I'll give you the drugs. You give me the money.
I started dealing with different people.
Okay.
More dangerous people.
Yeah. Outside of,
yeah,
quote unquote friends.
Yeah. I mean, to the point where a friend of mine, she left a gun at my house in hopes that I would protect myself. And I, you know, I'm not that type. I'm not that guy, but the gun ended up getting me in trouble.
And you go from just getting enough to get all of your quote unquote friends by to larger and larger quantities, I assume.
And unfortunately, just then it led to, I don't know how illicit you want me to talk about, but people know what drugs are. So
yeah,
I mean, it goes to, you know, cocaine, to marijuana, to ecstasy, to you know, other things that you would never, you know, smoking crack, you know, all these things that people wanted. I found that they wanted to do different things, and so I was their go-to guy to find what they wanted.
So it went from just being the cocaine and the parties and the things like that, and then you got into this life as your new source of income, essentially.
Yep.
And I'm assuming that when that happens, you have to find more and more ways to keep that income coming, because there's only so much demand for one specific drug.
And I would find that I knew some guys that wanted some pot, so I would trade the pot for some coke and then trade these pills for that. And it was got to be a game to me. And I thought, wow, I'm really doing good at this game. I'm making more money than I did at my job. This is kind of fun. It's damaging, yeah, but it was, quote, fun at the time, yeah.
Did your family have any inclination that this was going on while it was happening?
There was a point, a good friend of mine, Quentin, and my dad came to visit me in Kansas City, and they sent me to rehab. And I stayed there a month, and I was sober for a month after that, but it didn't last.
Did they know about the dealing aspect, or were they just concerned about the use?
They were concerned about the use. I don't think they knew the depth of the dealing. I mean, most people, maybe, you know, not even people around here that,
sure,
I grew up with, knew the depth of it.
Mm. Right.
And I do have to ask about that. You know, we talk about small town America, small town Kansas and things like that. I go back to your mention of anxiety and things like that. Did you ever feel like anytime you walked into a room, people maybe knew what was happening and were maybe talking about it? Did that ever play in the back of your mind at all?
Yeah. And family situations and in strange situations in Kansas City, both. Mm. You know, I was nervous that my family would not accept me anymore. I was nervous up in Kansas City if I walked into a new room, if I was going to get beaten up, stabbed, you know, or whatever. Or I mean, or worse, just crazy things, yeah.
Did that ever at any time curtail you away from this, or did it just push you further into it?
I mean, it was a roller coaster. There were times where I would quit for a little while, and I wouldn't owe anybody any money. I was sitting good on money. I didn't have any drugs around for a month or two. And then all of a sudden, you know.
You just fell back into it.
Basically, it happened when people would call me, and then I would, sooner or later, I'd be like, yeah, I can do that.
Trying to please them, maybe, going back to what Kagan was saying earlier, you know, it doesn't fill the entire void, but it just fills a part of it, and let's face it, most reasonings for using drugs, whether it's nicotine, alcohol, marijuana, cocaine, etc., you're trying to fill something in your own life. Most people just can't go out and do something just once or twice and be, oh, you know, I just did it for fun. It actually meant something to you mentally to do that drug. It took over something in your body that made you feel good, and that's why most people get addicted.
Correct.
Well, and I'm going to make this analogy, and I don't mean it towards you personally, but it's the class clown syndrome that they talk about. You know, the kid who acts out in class, they get one laugh, and then they need that laugh more, so they never focus in class, and things just kind of go off the rails. Not calling you the class clown by any means, Corbin, but I feel like, is that something, you know, you had that adulation, you had that respect, then once you decided to back away from it, after a while it nags at you, you want to go back to it, essentially.
Yeah, it does. But it's just like, it's never as fulfilling as it was the last time.
Right.
Until you strive and strive and strive. And that's, looking back, that's also, I'm glad that like the people like Kevin Love and Simone Biles are bringing mental health to the forefront, because looking back, that's what that was. And if I would have just talked to somebody, counselor, friends, family, and reached out, I know that would have helped then.
Yeah, you're still selling telecom.
Yeah.
Maybe going to happy hour and then going home.
Right, yeah, spend an hour at happy hour.
Sure.
Well, and I'm curious about that, though. Do you think that if you had talked to somebody and you still went to the happy hours, do you think you could have walked away from it? Do you think you could have gone to the happy hour, had a drink or two, and then just gone home?
I'll never know. No, that's a great question, and I'll never know. I just know that finally when I got smacked upside the head with a 90-month prison sentence, that made me start seeing straight, you know? Yeah.
Well, and it's...
And maybe it took that, you know?
Right.
Absolutely.
And it's not... There's always a point for somebody. You always hear, well, if the person this is talking about, somebody going to rehab, well, if they don't want it, it's kind of pointless to send them to rehab. You almost have to hit... And everybody has a different rock bottom.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some people I know, they go out and they drank too much one night and came home and threw up and fell asleep by the toilet, and that was it for them. Mm-hmm. That was their rock bottom. I don't want to do that again.
Just that one time. Yeah.
I can personally say that was when I decided I'm not going to drink very regularly. I had that happen in college. I was like, no, I'm good.
And I know people that have been in the hospital with alcohol poisoning, and they got out, and that wasn't rock bottom enough for them. So it's a different rock bottom for everyone, and I think that's probably the case with every drug. Well, let's take a break here, and we'll come back, and we'll talk about we've kind of talked about crime and some choices, but we'll talk about where the crime led to your next part of your life. You're listening to the On Air Chat. This is KVOE AM 1400 and 96.9 FM. We are live and local.
Income is the outcome that matters most in retirement. I'm Craig Barnwell with CB Financial, and I've been in retirement and wealth planning for over 25 years. If I doubled your portfolio, that might not change your lifestyle. You'd still be you. However, if I doubled your income, that could make a significant impact on your retirement. So whether you're retired or you want to see how soon that can happen, give us a call to set up a free, no-obligation visit. You can reach us at 620-208-6777. That's 620-208-6777. Retire happy. Retire with CB Financial.
Bruce Davis Construction, your go-to guys when you need commercial dirt work. From demolition to prepare for a building site or parking lot to dirt work and hauling, Bruce Davis will give you a quality job. Bruce Davis Construction, proud to be involved in recent construction jobs including the addition at Emporia High School, Emporia Travel Plaza, Glendale, and the David Trailer Zoo. Call Bruce Davis Construction at 342-5001.
1014 KVOE is proud to bring you Feel Good Fridays.
It puts you in the best mood.
Share the good news. If you are tired of hearing all the bad stuff, let us know anything good we should all know about. Call 342-1400 or email KVOE at KVOE.com. And we will feature a story every Friday.
It makes you feel good.
14 KVOE, live. We want your good news and local.
The one you depend on, KVOE, 1400 AM, 96.9 FM, live and local. It is time now for a check of local headlines being brought to you by the Insurance Planning Center. See Roger Winfrey for commercial lines or Barb Cristiani for personal lines at the Insurance Planning Center with offices in Emporia and Eureka. Now from the 24-hour KVOE newsroom, here is Chuck Samples.
Thanks, Scott. Good morning, everybody. Another event has now been adjusted due to COVID-19. The Big Brothers Big Sisters Serving Lyon County Brews and Bites event set for this upcoming Friday has now been pushed to October 28th. This follows the Emporia Area Chamber of Commerce announcement that it was canceling its rescheduled annual meeting, the in-person meeting that was set for August 25th at Emporia State's Webb Hall. A little brighter news for the activities yesterday through the hashtag VaxToNormal campaign with its walk-through vaccination clinic taking place before Abundant Harvest had its mobile food pantry activity. About 15 people were vaccinated for that. And home sales were up, active listings down for Emporia last month. The Sunflower Association of Realtors said Emporia's total home sales went from 60 units to 64 year-to-year. That's up 6.7%. KVOE forecast from the TV 13 weather team. Another steamer today with a high of 99 degrees. Heat index readings at 103 to 109. We'll see an overnight low of 77 tonight. Tomorrow, 97 for the high with a chance of storms. A little bit cooler conditions coming in for Friday with a high of 89, and again, a chance of storms. From the 24-hour KVOE newsroom, I'm Chuck Samples.
Thank you, Chuck. We're seeing a 23-mile-an-hour south wind. Wind gusts is over 30 miles an hour here already this morning. Sunny skies and 86 degrees. Headlines, a service of the Insurance Planning Center, 726 Commercial, downtown Emporia, just east of Jimmy John's. Things happen, and IPC is there to help when they do. KBOE, 1400 AM, 96.9 FM, live and local. Now back to the on-air chat.
Welcome back to the on-air chat. Tegan Trahoon, Aaron Harder hosting. Corey Basilevac is our guest. I know the book is titled Corbin Basilevac, but I've called you Corey my whole life. I'm going to keep calling you Corey.
I saw you struggling with it earlier on when we started off. You were like, Corbin.
Yeah, I did. Basilevac. I did.
I'm A-okay with either one.
Okay, perfect. Okay, in the first segment, we kind of discussed where basically from birth to quitting your job to be a full-time drug dealer. So you're not gainfully employed, and you got about 4 years here of strictly dealing drugs only. During that time, are you fearful of getting caught?
Completely, yeah. But I didn't care, because a lot of times when you start doing drugs again, you just forget.
Right.
Your mind unfocuses for a day or two, and it's all gone.
Right.
Were you fearful of the law itself, or were you more fearful of the people that you were working with?
I was not fearful of the law so much, because I assumed that the law would treat me okay. Like, yeah. It wouldn't hurt me or kill me. They could just lock me up. But no, I was fearful of the people, yeah.
You were fearful of the repercussions that might come if you got busted, especially if somebody was supplying you or something.
Right.
Like that.
Mainly if I still owed them money or if they thought I was going to talk about them. Those two things. Mm.
So you're not gainfully employed, but you are working for a living. What happens after about that 4 year time frame? Are you at home? Are you somewhere else? Where are you when when the PD comes.
And so it happened in a snap. You know, I was going about my business. I had a little route around the plaza I would do. And I stopped home to re-up or get some things, drop some money off or whatever. And it goes in detail of that in the book, but just basically they showed up at my house and it was a mess. The SWAT team showed up at my house and the federal government was stationed up the street. So I had jumped out the window, got away from 8 SWAT team members somehow, ran up the street, ran through 2 DEA members. And then ran 3 or 4 blocks to my girlfriend's house. And so I got away temporarily, but you know.
Were you, when you saw the force that was coming for you, I mean, you mentioned a SWAT team, federal agents, DEA, were you kind of sitting there at any point in your mind just going, wow, all this for me?
Yes, completely. I figured I'd get a traffic stop, you know, that would be the extent.
Traffic stop, cuffed, and
yeah, I figured that would be what it was, not that.
And we skipped something that we talked off the air about. You're basically 4 years into this, and you're dealing and using
heavily both. Yes,
right. So at that, are you on something when they come to get you?
I'm on at least 3 things.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's more the adrenaline that takes over, because you'd stated that you're not fearful of the police doing something wrong to you, but obviously. You're a smart guy. Obviously, you know, running from them isn't the greatest thing, but also the adrenaline just has to take over. I know I did something wrong. I got to get out of here.
And looking back, who jumps out a window?
Right.
Unless there's a fire.
Right.
Or a home invasion or something. But that's what it was, a home invasion.
So you make it to your girlfriend's house.
Mm-hmm.
Or they shortly after you?
They find me shortly after, yeah.
Was she hiding you, or?
She was not happy I was there.
I...
She didn't approve or like what I was doing. It's not, she knew, but she spent a lot of time trying to get me to stop. They showed up. She had just showered. She was in like a nightie, all clean, you know, ready to go to bed. I think they busted in. At some point I passed out. Like, I think I had a foot on my neck and a gun to my head when they were finally taking me in, because I was flailing and being dumb, you know, and they were just doing what they do.
If you hadn't been on something at that time, do you think that you would have just, as soon as they came in the door, you would have been on the ground, just hands over your head, ready to go, or?
I would hope so. I haven't been on something for a long time,
yeah.
And I think of myself as a pretty rational person and pretty calm most of the time, and so, yeah, I would think so. I would just take it as it came.
And you didn't have fear of the police, so to say, fear of your life from the police. And you'd always thought it was going to be a traffic stop or something. So I would assume that someone that wasn't using at the time would probably go peacefully. It probably could have been mm-hmm. a knock on the door. But you also don't know what information they have.
Mm-hmm.
And how is this a violent offender? Is it? And I assume if they know at least half of what you've been dealing, they're just going to lump that in with a violent offender. Is that a safe assumption?
I would say so. They had enough information to get the federal government involved.
See, and I just had 2 more questions, and I wanted to move on to the next part to get to everything in this book. But was there ever a part of you that wanted to be caught? I mean, did you ever, while this was happening, sit to yourself and go, man, I just wanted to get arrested, or maybe I want to turn myself in, you know? Because we hear about sometimes people that go through this, they think about, I was just ready to be caught because I didn't want to have to worry about it anymore.
Yeah, I would say there was. And hopefully when you get caught, it's kind of a slap on the wrist type situation. You know, do some drug rehab or do 90 days in jail, but not 90 months.
Well, and I'm sure once you saw that the federal government was there, I'm sure you probably thought that the slap on the wrist possibility was out the window.
Right.
No pun intended, I apologize.
No, you're exactly right. They mean business.
Well, and that's my last question for you on this particular topic. And how did the federal agents get involved in this? What led to their involvement in this case? Because it seems more like a regional or mm-hmm. local kind of issue, not a federal issue.
I asked my attorney that several times, and he said, you had a gun, and that somebody knew I had a gun, money, and drugs in the same safe in my house. And that alone gets the federal government involved.
Were you traveling across state lines with any of this, or?
Yeah, I mean, Kansas City is both Kansas and Missouri,
right.
So yeah.
So that becomes a federal issue.
And by federal government, you're talking ATF?
DEA.
DEA,
yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I didn't think it was the FBI busting it.
Yeah.
That's basically once you cross over, even if it's Kansas to Missouri, which is a pretty easy crossover.
That's unfortunately where we live. That's yeah. how it is right there.
And
yeah.
unfortunately, that immediately, at least to my knowledge, makes it a federal issue. No matter which state line you cross state lines with anything like that.
Well, I, and like Corey said, I'm sure if he would have just stayed on the Missouri yeah. side, it's probably the same issue with all that stuff in one location.
Another piece of information they had, I stupidly lived in Missouri, had a storage unit in Kansas. And so that right there, I mean, it just it escalates.
And you had some of the stuff involved with this case on both sides.
Correct.
Okay. Yeah. Gotcha.
So they come, they cuff you, they take you down to the local precinct.
Mm-hmm.
How long until trial? And what are you doing until trial?
I got let out. I didn't know I would be, but since I'd never been in trouble before, I got signed out the next morning. And at that point, they said I had to come back and get arraigned. Mm-hmm. And that took like maybe 6 months, because the federal government just doesn't move as quickly as... It might have taken five, I'm not sure, but they just don't move quick.
It took longer than you thought it would.
Oh, it took way longer than I thought. And then I was put on pretrial bond, which is basically like parole. I had to report mm-hmm. to a guy down at the – I had to report to the federal marshals every week.
Now, during the arraignment process, were you still released on your own recognizance, or were you in a jail cell those 5 months while you're waiting for the arraignment?
No, luckily I was not. Yeah, I was just out – And I kind of fell back into trying to make up for the money I had lost and the product I had lost. So I was doing drugs a little bit, but it was not the same. And it was, I was a shell of my former self.
Did you owe people at
yeah,
the time of arrest?
I did. And somehow I made that right. That was the first thing on my mind.
To get that right.
Even if I had no money, I right. wanted to get that right. Because
so you could go in whole.
So I could go in whole. I can walk around with my head held high and not, yeah.
You're talking, and I know all of this is more and more detail. You can't really do the book justice on air, and you got to leave something for people to go and read. But when you're talking with your lawyer, he is saying, I mean, you're going in. There's no doubt about it.
From day one, he was kind of saying, you know, there's no choice. The federal government, what they're charging you with, there's no fighting them.
We know it's happening. We just don't know the length.
And we don't know the extent and mm-hmm. what they're going to come with.
So you get the people that you owe whole. You're still kind of using, but not as much as you used to. At what point do you stop using and get sober?
So about a year after that arrest, when the SWAT team came, I was using, I was selling, but it was, like you said, not like it was. And so there was one day where I was using heavy drugs basically all day. And my girlfriend, I was supposed to meet her at 7 p.m. that night. And so after doing drugs all day long, you know, you're just out of your mind. I remember walking over to her house. I felt like a gorilla, like a drunken gorilla stumbling through the forest. You know, it was just horrible. And I must have looked bad, because I showed up at her house and she looked at me and she was just like, she said one word, and it goes in more detail in the book, but she said one word. She goes, really? like really, this is what's happening right now? And so at that point we sat down, we talked, and I knew that it was over with. I was going to go to jail anyway. I couldn't keep doing what I was going to kill myself by using drugs if I didn't stop. And that's the last time I did drugs, was that day.
When you guys talked, were you allowed to go to a rehab? Did your lawyer ever suggest that? Did the marshals ever suggest it? Or was it just cold turkey quit?
They kind of aren't supportive in that sense. I saw a counselor. Okay. I did, once a week.
So you did have somebody to talk to.
I did.
Did that help with the mental
health?
That
certainly helped. It helped in ways that I got mad at her, but in a good way, you know? Yeah. It brought things out that helped, yes.
You said that they weren't supportive in that way, you know, so they weren't offering you any kind of drug rehabilitation or any kind of programs to help you get clean. They basically were like, you got to figure it out.
For the most part, I didn't know this at the time, but I learned that federal prison and the BOP, the Bureau of Prisons, is like a warehouse for people. And they have programs in there that you can do. They really do. I mean, I shouldn't say they don't do anything for you. They do have programs.
But you're talking once you get in.
Once you get in.
And you're technically not in yet.
I'm not in yet.
And that's what I meant. Yeah, during this whole time when you're still going through the court process, mm-hmm. they're not doing anything to give you any help.
It's less help. It's more they want to hold you down. They want to make sure you go give urine tests for drugs. And they want you to report to somebody to make sure you're not committing crimes. But they don't – I mean, I did talk to a counselor, but I kind of had to seek that out myself. And they make sure you're not going to hurt yourself or hurt somebody else. You know, you're in the right frame of mind. But
they're not completely off to the side, but they're not standing right behind you being like, here, we're going to help you.
Not so much. Yeah, not so much.
So you're sober for about a year, and then do you go to trial, or do you just plead guilty?
I ended up just pleading guilty. I was going to fight it, but I just pled guilty, and I got a longer sentence than I thought I was going to get. There was a sentence agreement. You know, I thought I was going to get about 30 months. I got 90.
What would you have gotten if you tried to fight it? I mean, what were you looking at if you went to trial?
The reason I took what I thought was going to be 30 is I was facing 35 years.
Oh, jeez.
And that's a lifetime.
Yeah.
And
how old were you when this happened?
I was in mid-30s.
So, yeah, that's basically, you'd be, what, 65 by the time you got
65,
out?
65, 70, yeah. And so, and if there's a better than average chance I'm going to get 35 years, you're gonna figure out something else.
Absolutely.
So that's why I pleaded down.
And when they're talking, are they trying to get more info out of you as well? Like, who are the guys above you in line and all that kind of stuff? Where'd you get the gun and all that kind of stuff?
They were, yeah. And I really didn't go get into it a lot with them in that because
right.
I knew it wasn't going to do me any good.
Right.
I figured that justice would prevail and I might get some time, but I wouldn't get the 35 years. You know, the truth would come out and they'd be like, okay, you had this much and you only did this and it was okay.
Right.
Yeah.
It wasn't that you didn't cooperate. It's just that you knew the information you had wasn't going to make much of a difference. And all it was going to do is basically put you at more risk.
Right. Oh yeah, certainly. If I start talking about people above me that are dangerous people, yeah, that's not going to do me any good.
Especially when you're going into federal prison,
yeah,
where
right.
they probably have contacts.
Yeah, yeah.
So mentally, you've kind of had 2 years to prepare yourself that you're probably going to go in, according mm-hmm. to your lawyer's first comments to you. So you get the 90, you're probably disappointed that it wasn't the 30. I'm sure there was a range when you agreed, and then the judge
went
came
above.
Down with the sentencing. So your first day in, talk about what all that involved. You don't have to go into a ton of detail because I know it's all in the book. But your first day in, where are you? Where what Fed prison are you in? And are you prepared at all for it, or is it just all completely out of the blue?
I'm prepared a little bit, but you can't prepare. I mean, unless I would have talked to some more people. So it cramps your mind, and when you get in your first holding cell, even if you're only in there for 20, 30 minutes, it seems like 20 days. I mean, every minute is like hours. Another chapter in my book talks about diesel therapy. The first 18 months I was in prison, or I was incarcerated in custody, I was at 8 or 9 different locations. So they kept shipping me and moving me around. And they kind of do that on purpose, one, to break you down and not let you get used to things. Two, kind of keep you safe because that way you're not around. They can kind of keep an eye on you. But the problem is when you're in diesel therapy, I called it, or when they're moving you around, you're locked inside small rooms all day long. Basically, you're locked in a room the size of an apartment bathroom.
Were you in protective custody because
no.
of what you knew, or is it just that was just a circumstance?
That was a circumstance. I was never in. They would let us go out to the yard sometimes for like 30 minutes at a time or an hour. Mm-hmm. And so I did that, but I was never in protective custody, no.
Gotcha.
So you're moving around 8 or 9 times in a year and a half time frame, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And then you land at your final destination incarceration, or
yeah, the final place. I liked where I was at. I mean, it was closest to home. It was Leavenworth, and so that way I was right up the road from my mom and my family. But yeah, I mean, when they moved me around, I moved even out to Atlanta and Oklahoma City and Memphis, like places where I was. I mean, there was
those are all busings.
Conair, buses, small vehicle, anything. Yeah.
Was Conair without Nicolas Cage?
Without cages and things like that.
Was Steve Buscemi on the flight?
Right, right.
Was he singing "I Got the Whole World in My Hands"?
In my hands.
so you're in. You probably there's. I don't know if I want to say friends to make, but moving around so much in that first 18 months, where you started on day one to where you probably didn't know anyone or become friendly with anyone. Maybe one or two guys traveled to each place with you or not. But once you get to Leavenworth, you start getting involved in prison life a little bit. Let's expand on that.
Well, finally, at that place, you can get work assignments where you can make a little money. Not much, but $20 to $50 a month, but wow, which isn't much. But you need, you know, you don't need to spend money on much. So luckily, I fell right into. I met a one of the guards that he liked my demeanor and he liked something about me, and he said, "I'm going to start a project. It's this community service garden project where we have Lions Club and other donors that are going to give us seeds. We're going to grow the food, and then we're going to in turn donate the food back to battered women's shelters and churches and homeless folks that need it." And so I was like, "Well, that sounds like a way to do a penance for my wrongs, at least make a difference in something bigger than myself rather than just, you know, lifting weights and reading books," which I did that too, but I wanted to do something that reached beyond myself. And
you'd mentioned like your behavior, your choices up to this point hadn't really harmed anybody. It wasn't anything that you were doing that was causing any bodily harm or anything like that to your knowledge. But you felt that you still owed a penance for what you had done, and by supporting these different organizations and doing this, that was going to maybe kind of wipe the slate clean, or at least maybe balance it more in your favor?
Karma, yeah. The universe, you know, the energy of how things work. You always want to be on the right side of the energy. And,
right.
And I figured that the more good I could do, the better off I would be, yeah.
Let's take a break. We'll come back. We'll talk about the change. The changes that happened during incarceration and all the change that's happened since. You're listening to the On Air Chat. This is KVOE. We are live and local.
Hi, Greg Barnwell with CB Financial. I've been in retirement and wealth planning for over 25 years. I can help you get the most sustainable income out of your Social Security, your 401ks, your IRAs, and your brokerage account. When you know what's coming in this month, next month, and every month, you'll be able to enjoy retirement to the fullest. Give me a call to set up a free, no-obligation visit. Retire happy, retire with CB Financial. You can reach us at 620-208-6777.
Bruce Davis Construction, your go-to guys when you need commercial dirt work. From demolition to prepare for a building site or parking lot to dirt work and hauling, Bruce Davis will give you a quality job. Bruce Davis Construction, proud to be involved in recent construction jobs including the addition at Emporia High School, Emporia Travel Plaza, Glendale, and the David Trailer Zoo. Call Bruce Davis Construction at 342-5001.
KVOE's Hide and Seek Contest is back.
Yay!
Find the medallion with a valid hunting license, and you win $5,000 in cash and prizes. KVOE, 96.9 FM and 1400 AM. Live. Stay tuned or log on to KVOE.com for hide and seek details. And local.
KVOE, 1400 AM, 96.9 FM, live and local. It is time now for sports headlines being brought to you by Bruff Sports Bar and Grill, featuring daily lunch specials, a menu full of fresh food, and your favorite beverages as well. Bruff Sports Bar and Grill, 2640 West 18th. Now with KVOE Sports Headlines, here is Greg Ray.
Thank you, Scott, and good morning. Salvador Perez hit two home runs to help power the Kansas City Royals to an 8-4 win over the New York Yankees last night. Perez hit the two home runs on the 10th anniversary of his Major League debut. Now hit 29 home runs this season. That's a new single-season career high for him. Royals and Yankees wrap up the three-game series this afternoon. Brady Singer makes a start for the Royals. First pitch set for 1:10. You can hear the game here on KVOE. Emporia State football team holding their first practice today. Opponents will hold 21 practices before they kick off the season September 4th at Northeastern State. In case you're wondering, Emporia State volleyball and women's soccer team will hold their first practices this coming Monday. Don't forget, we'll have another Emporia State training camp report coming your way this afternoon around 4:45 or following Royals baseball. Today's a non-practice day for the Kansas City Chiefs. They'll return to practice tomorrow, then travel to San Francisco on Friday for Saturday's preseason game against the 49ers. We'll have another Chiefs training camp report with Mitch Holtz's Voice of the Chiefs coming your way at about 5:45 this afternoon or following our 5:40 sportscast. Kansas men's basketball team received a big commitment yesterday. The Athletic reporting that MJ Rice, a five-star prospect in the class of 2022, announced that he was committed to play for the Jayhawks. Rice is a 6'5 small forward out of prolific Prep, California. He was the 20th ranked player in the 24/7 sports composite rankings. That's Look at Sports. I'm Greg Ray, KVOE, live and local.
Thank you, Greg. Sports headlines, a service of Bruff Sports Bar and Grill, featuring daily lunch specials, a menu full of fresh food, and your favorite beverages as well. Bruff Sports Bar and Grill, 2640 West 18th. And the new Sunday hours, don't forget, 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. KBOE, 1400 AM, 96.9 FM, live and local. Now back to the on-air chat.
Welcome back to the on-air chat. Tegan Trahoon, Aaron Harder hosting. Corey Basilevec is our guest. We kind of ended the last segment. You're incarcerated, serving a 90-month sentence. You've started a community garden project that wasn't small, about 14 acres. Is that right?
Correct, yeah.
It's a pretty good-sized garden.
Small farm, yeah.
Yeah. And what are some other things you're doing while you're incarcerated to, quote-unquote, better yourself?
I picked up the guitar and started playing it with another guy who played piano, a buddy of mine I ended up spending time with up there in Kansas City. We played at church events and services on Sundays, but when we practiced a couple times during the week.
Okay, and obviously there's plenty of time. So you're lifting weights, probably playing cards with the guys. What else are you doing? What are you doing for books?
Well, I mean, when I was locked up in small rooms during the transfer time of my phase, I really started thinking about things differently. Luckily, I call it God, but I mean, I read books on Hinduism and Buddhism and Stephen Hawking and the Bible, and I read a bunch of stuff, and I started thinking about life in a bigger sense, the energy of the universe and how things work, and I just knew that I wanted to be part of something bigger than whatever the heck it was I'd been doing for the past so many years.
And you're sober since the night with your girlfriend when she says, really, was there times where you were tempted while you were incarcerated?
Not as much as you would think.
Okay.
You know what? You get your mind right and life starts happening better. And well, no, yeah.
And jumping off of what he just asked, was there readily available supply for if you wanted to, you could have fallen off the wagon?
Yes. K2 and opiates, and Adderall, stuff like that, those were more prevalent than anything else, yeah.
Okay, so you're serving 90 months. Do you come up for parole after 30 months? What's the process of you getting out?
I didn't really have a long enough sentence to come up for parole, but there are reviews, and you meet with a case manager every 6 months to see how things are going, see if any new laws have been passed, see if any of the paperwork, because it seemed like everybody was submitting paperwork to the courts to try to get their sentence shortened for any loophole they could find, bad or good. So, and I had done the same, and I submitted at least three or four documents, and one of them ended up coming through, so I got a little bit of time off my sentence, namely because of the garden project. Good behavior, good doing something that was actually noticeable, because there were people on the outside that talked to politicians that actually said, oh, this is actually affecting us.
And, you know, I was going to ask you about that. Did your decisions, you know, you talk about choices again, you know, choices and change. Obviously, you started changing because of some of the choices that you had there. Do you think that those choices deliberately led to the fact that you got out a little bit earlier than you were anticipating?
I think so. I mean, I couldn't have made those choices myself. It was my belief in the energy of the universe that I think led me down those things. Yeah.
Now, something we hear about when people are being released from jail, because I think that's kind of where we're heading right now. You know, they're being released. They have a fear of going back into the real world because you mentioned you had a 7.5-year sentence. You served just a little over 6. Mm-hmm. That's still a long time. Was there ever any concerns about reacclimating to normal life? I mean, because I understand I've personally never been to prison, let alone federal prison. But my understanding is it's very structured. You don't really have a lot of free say in what you do. Was there any concern about that freedom that you were going to be getting back?
Sure, because I had purposely institutionalized myself, because that makes life easier in there. You're on a schedule. You do this at this time. You listen to the guards. You do as you say, do as they say, and so you can't live like that in the real world, though. I mean, you can, but it's. I didn't want to. I wanted to revert and get back to a person that I wanted to be that could live freely. So it was. I was nervous getting out of prison. Yeah.
You mentioned purposely institutionalized yourself. Obviously, when you're institutionalized or you're put in jail, you don't really have much choice but to follow the kind of toe the line, although some people won't. But you say purposefully institutionalize yourself, were you looking for some stability that maybe you didn't have the prior several years leading up to your incarceration?
I would say the first couple years, even when I was in jail, I was bucking the system, not in a bad way, but I just would like not talk to people. I would think that I could just be on my own or not conform to what was going on, kind of hide, but you can't hide. You know, you're there whether you like it or not. And so somebody talked to me and I finally realized I just got to be here, you know, and I got to be in it and absorb it all and then just be part of it. And then once I did that, honestly, I couldn't believe it, how much easier it made things. You accepted things.
It was a change, but it was a very positive change.
Sure. Yeah, it sure was. Mm.
Is there counseling while you're in?
There is. I saw a counselor from almost the day I got there because I sought it out. I filled out paperwork to get, I just wanted to talk to somebody.
Sure.
And mainly because they would let me out of the room I was locked up in for an hour, you know?
Well, and the talking had to help. Obviously, you talked about counseling and that had to have helped your mental state, your anxiety and all of that. That just talking to somebody, we all know it. Just it's sometimes it's the hardest thing to do, but mm-hmm. it's always the best thing to do. So that obviously helped your mental state.
It certainly did. And then right away, the lady that I was talking to, she suggested I start writing, you know, write a journal. And then she said, "How's that coming?" I said, "I don't know. It's great." And she read some and she's like, "Have you ever thought about writing a book?" Mm. That was early on too. And so that inspired me.
And you went to KU for journalism. Right. So you had a little bit of experience there. But was writing ever something you found yourself doing? Was that ever mm-hmm. something that you looked at and said, "I could do that"?
Yeah. I actually, the job I got right out of college, I had actually applied to work for the publishing side of this telecom company in Iowa. And they said, "Well, we need people on the actual technology side." So, but yeah, I like writing. I always have.
Well, and going forward here, I mean, you've changed your life, obviously, not dealing drugs anymore, out of prison now. How long have you been out now?
About 2 years.
2 years.
How does it seem longer?
Time's going by real fast, I'll say that.
Well, you get out, and then, of course, a pandemic hits. I got to imagine that was quite a whirlwind.
It's been crazy for everybody, yeah. And I will say this, that once the pandemic hit, I honestly, it didn't affect me as much as it probably would have a lot of people because I can deal with problems a lot easier now. Things don't seem as big. A car accident and flat tire, those don't bug me as much as they would once have because
You jumped out a window from federal agents.
Yes. I mean, yeah.
Well, but with that in mind, when you got out, the pandemic happens. Were you very happy that you were out and not in prison while that was going on?
Yeah, I can imagine what these guys are going through in there. The no visits for about a year or whatever it was is what I heard. That's just the visits are what get you through in there. Seeing a real person come in with real clothes on and not khakis or orange. Mm. So yeah, I can't even imagine.
Well, again, the book, it's called On to the Next Thing. How did you choose that title? Where did that title come from?
Awesome question. I'm very proud of this because it's a phrase that we uttered to ourselves, other inmates, guys that I would eat lunch with or guys that I was in work assignments with. You know, we're always seeing each other every day mm-hmm. and we're always locked up in the same corridors. Mm-hmm. So we'd eat, we'd finish eating, and we'd be like, "Well, on to the next thing." Or if we at work, and then we had to go back for count, "Well, on to the next thing." And it just kind of kept, it was a little positive saying that just kept us going forward every day.
You have a foreword in here written by a very well-known individual, two-time Super Bowl champ, Leonard Marshall. How did that connection come about?
So my dad works in New York City. He and my dad actually worked together on some health issues. And Leonard has a relative that had kind of gone through the same things I had. So he wrote me while I was in prison. And then when I got out, I finally got to go hang out with him in New York, go out and eat, you know, spend time up there. And I said, "You know what? This is crazy. What if you could do this for me?" And he said, well, certainly, you know, if it makes a difference.
Well, and it probably helped him quite a bit as well. Because I'm sure he's writing about you, but also about his relative at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Sure, and he's a big advocate up there for just guys bettering themselves in general, whether it be ex-NFL players or current NFL players that aren't spending their money right, or they're using drugs or any, you know, lots of different things.
Well, and I like that Harder brings up the fact that, you know, it's probably cathartic for him too because of his relative going through the same thing. He gets to see that there can be a positive outcome. You talked about reading about Buddhism and Hinduism, all these different things in jail. and how it kind of gave you a different perspective on life. A lot of people would look at it and, you know, say, well, I made a big mistake. I did this and that. But, I mean, if it weren't for those experiences, you wouldn't be here right now. You wouldn't have these connections. You wouldn't have had these opportunities. Do you think it was kind of one of those things of, you know, the old saying, God never gives us more than we can handle? Do you feel that this was, in a way, kind of an embodiment of that saying, or do you think that it was just, it all kind of was a coincidence?
No, you're right. It was an embodiment of that. And a lot of times I thought I couldn't handle it. Mm. And I found a way to handle it. If you're locked in a room for days on end, or you're around a bunch of people who are just nagging at you and trying to start fights with you, or anything, you know, dangerous situations. But yeah, I think all the testing made me stronger.
Just my last question, really. What do you hope this book accomplishes? I mean, what's, for you, the ultimate goal here? Because you'd mentioned you didn't want to hide anything. You wanted to be as transparent as you possibly could with this memoir. What's the ultimate goal for you?
I hope it's two things, and then I can expand on this, but I hope it's entertaining enough that people want to read it, and it's, you know, they like what they hear, and it's eye-popping and whatnot. But I also want it to be encouraging. And encouraging to the point where it's not just a bestseller on Amazon or anything like that, but there's groups like addiction specialists or mental health counselors or people that want to use this book as to open up people's eyes up to, you know, you can grow up in a normal place like Emporia, have a great upbringing and go to college, mm-hmm. and you can still make bad choices and you can still have a lot of bad things happen to you, and you can still come out the other end and have a great, joyous life.
Maybe a movie deal? Not another question?
Funny you say that. I'm leaving I'm leaving on a plane here in a couple hours to go to Florida to record the audiobook.
That's awesome.
And it was on suggestion by some people so I could submit it to some places in L.A. It's a long shot like anything else, but if you don't try it, you don't get it. So.
Sure. Absolutely.
How much relief did you get, or what did you get out of writing the book?
It was almost easier writing the book because I wrote it while I was in prison from all the years of journals I put together. And so when I got out and I was on a home confinement in my mom's house, I would sit and look through those journals and I would write. And then I would erase something and write some more.
Did you feel like you were reliving a bad time in your life, or have you changed enough? And it seems some people get incarcerated and don't ever want to talk about it. Mm-hmm. Or like my dad went to Vietnam, never talked about it. He just wanted, it happened, it's in the past, I don't ever want to talk about it again. Obviously, you're very open in the book about it. The two or three times I've seen you around and brought it up with you, you've been open with me about it. Does reliving and telling the story, that's also part of the change, is it not?
Certainly. And at the expense of my ego and to humble myself, I want to be open about it because I want it to help people more than anything. I think I'm strong enough in my own devices that I can handle the criticism, because, I mean, I've done a lot of horrible stuff and made stupid decisions. So I don't know how, you know, you can bring me even further down. So I want it to help people.
Sometimes your bad decisions can be a roadmap for somebody else.
I certainly hope so.
Well, Corey, thanks a lot for being in. Thanks for being so candid. I think a lot of people will find it interesting. And where can they go and get the book?
Well, right now the book is available at Nature's Paradise Health Food Store over on 6th Street. They got some copies there. Go check it out locally. You can buy it there. You can also go to bluepressmedia.com if you want. That's the publishing company that I've set up, and there's some information there, not just about this book, but other books that we have coming out.
Well,
thanks again for joining us. The book is On to the Next Thing, a memoir on crime, choices, and change by Corbin Basilovac. Tegan, thanks for co-hosting with me, my friend.
Hey, my pleasure. I've always been wanting to do this, so I'm excited I got to. And it's a fun topic to discuss, though I know it's been troublesome in your life, Corbin. It's so exciting to kind of hear this and see where you've come. So thanks for taking the time to come in and talk with us.
Guys, I really appreciate it. I had a good time.
Thanks for listening to the On Air Chat. We've been brought to you by Bruce Davis Construction. For commercial dirt work, demolition, dirt hauling, and more, call Bruce Davis Construction, 342-5001. And CB Financial, retire happy, retire with CB Financial. See Craig Barnwell at 517 East 6th Avenue.